Even after 20 years of working in law enforcement, there were still some gruesome sights that made my stomach churn. I was standing at a residence located in Mallory Crescent, Lecito, Toronto, and I watched in horror as forensics uncovered numerous rotting and dismembered human remains. I tried to keep a straight face as the disfigured human parts were taken from the crime scene, but I couldn't. As I stood there, I started to remember the words of a fellow detective who once told me that the worst part of this job was getting used to it. When I first took this case, I thought it would be like the other missing persons I had worked on in the past. But I could have never imagined that I would end up chasing the deadliest serial killer Toronto, Canada has ever seen. It all started in Church and Wellesley, a neighborhood in Toronto, Canada. Church and Wellesley wasn't your everyday neighborhood, as it's widely known to the locals in Toronto as the Gay Village. It is home to one of the largest LGBTQ communities in Toronto, and the neighborhood is littered with bars, vibrant cafes, and exciting eateries. The village was often considered to be one of the safest places in Toronto, and most of the residents who moved there felt secure and protected. But that all changed in the year 2010, when residents of the village mysteriously started going missing. On the 6th of September 2010, a 40-year-old man named Skenderaj Skandam Navaratnam left his home and never returned the following day. He was officially reported missing on the 10th of September 2010, and an investigation was carried out to find his last location and whereabouts. The operation was carried out by the Toronto Police Service, who tried to put together a timeline that would lead to the missing man. But no matter how much the officers tried to find Mr. Navaratnam, it seemed like he had vanished into thin air. As time went by, things kept getting worse for the authorities, as while they were trying to locate Mr. Navaratnam, two additional people went missing from Church and Wellesley. Their names were Majid Hamid Kayan and Abdul Bashir Bashir Faiz. The 42-year-old man named Faiz was last seen on the 28th of October 2010, just 3 days after Christmas, and he was reported missing on the 29th of December 2010. The Toronto Police Service would add Mr. Faiz to the already ongoing missing persons search for Mr. Navaratnam, but these things were already looking bleak. Detectives know that the most important factor in a missing persons case is time. The first 72 hours are crucial, and most detectives either try to close the case in this time period or find a trace that can lead them to the person's location. However, if the reported missing person isn't found within that time frame, and if there are still no clues as to what might have happened to them, the outcome of the missing persons case starts to look very grim. With every passing day, the hopes of both the detectives and the victims' families kept dwindling, and it was only a matter of time before they began to assume the worst. At this point in the case, both Navaratnam and Faiz had been missing for 2 years. Some residents of Church and Wellesley still had hope, as there had been cases where a missing person appeared after 5 or even 10 years, but those cases were extremely rare, and the detectives already knew they were dead. The tensions in the Church and Wellesley neighborhood were reaching an all-time high now. People wanted answers that the authorities couldn't give, and amidst all this chaos, another man named Majid Hamid Kayan went missing on the 18th of October 2012. The now growing disappearances in the Church and Wellesley neighborhood baffled the authorities. They still didn't have any leads on the whereabouts of the first two missing men, and now a third person had vanished. The residents of Church and Wellesley were finding it hard to wrap their heads around the mysterious vanishings, as it was unheard of in the history of their neighborhood. Three people were now missing, and the authorities, who still had no leads, thought it couldn't get any worse than that. However, they would soon realize just how wrong they were, as in the following years, many more inhabitants of the Church and Wellesley neighborhood never made it back home. The disturbing trend of missing individuals in the gay village of Toronto continued on the 12th of August 2015, as the 50-year-old Sarush Mahudi went missing. The Toronto police didn't even have a chance to properly start an investigation into the Mahudi case, as that same month another missing person was reported. And it was the 37-year-old Karushna Kumar Karagaratnam. Two additional people had gone missing in 1 month, and after further investigations, no traces of them or their captors were found. It seemed like the person who was taking the residence of Church and Wellesley was an expert, because no matter what the authorities did, he or she couldn't be tracked. Due to the repeated kidnappings, the detectives who were working on the case assumed that the perpetrator would try to take someone the very next month, so they all remained on high alert. But it wasn't long before the detectives realized that their assumptions were wrong. The perpetrator didn't take anyone the next month or in the months that followed. The detectives believed the abductor was laying low due to the heat, which is why he didn't take anyone after that. Things would go quiet for a while after that, as no missing person cases were reported. But the calm didn't last long, as on the 21st of April, 2016, 43-year-old Dean Lisowick joined the list of missing people in Toronto, Canada. The abductor would strike twice in the year 2017. The first disappearance happened on the 20th of March, and the taken was a 44-year-old man named Salim Essen. It wasn't long after that before the second disappearance occurred on the 26th of June, and the missing was the 49-year-old man called Andrew Kinsman. Both the authorities and the municipal government of Toronto were extremely shocked now, because what had started as a simple missing persons case had now grown into a nationwide manhunt. Things were much worse for the residents of Church and Wellesley, because their neighborhood, which was once a safe haven, was now filled with fear and terror. Since the beginning of the missing persons cases, the authorities had been calling the perpetrator a kidnapper or an abductor to ease the fear and tension in the community. But at that point, both the detectives and the residents of Church and Wellesley knew the person who was doing all this wasn't a kidnapper, but a full-blown serial killer. With the growing unrest, the Toronto Police Service doubled its investigative efforts even more. They formed new dedicated task forces to focus all their efforts on finding the culprit. They carried out numerous investigations, interrogated every witness, and retraced the steps of all their victims. The operation was getting bigger and bigger each day as the Toronto Police Service called on the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, and the Ontario Provincial Police, OPP. Even after calling on the resources of the OPP and the RCMP, the investigation kept growing at an alarming rate. It eventually became one of the largest criminal investigations ever conducted by the Toronto Police Service, and they were still calling on assistance from other forensic, police, and detective services. It wasn't long after that before I received a call from the chief of the Toronto Police Service, asking me to help them bring this cold-blooded killer to justice. I can still recall the look on Chief Saunders' face when I stepped into his office that Monday morning. He had the look of a man who'd been through a lot, and it was clear to see that he just wanted to find the responsible person so that the whole nightmare would finally be over. After offering my partner and me a seat, Chief Saunders looked me in the eyes as he said,
"Good morning, Detective Matthew Stone and Junior Detective Emily Scott. I don't know if you are aware, but it's extremely hard to get a hold of you."
I smiled at him before responding with, "Well, I'm a very busy man, Chief Saunders, and my partner and I can only handle one case at a time." Chief Saunders then studied me for a few seconds before saying,
"I'm sure you're already aware of this messy case and the massive manhunt that's ravaging the city. I've got the entire Ontario Provincial Police and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police working on it. But due to the complexities of the case, we haven't been able to get anywhere in our investigations. I've been told by many other officers and detectives in law enforcement that you're nicknamed the Bloodhound, and if anyone can solve this case, it's you. I've also looked into your records myself, and the successes speak for themselves. That is why I called you and Detective Scott here to lend us your expertise and help this city to finally solve this case."
I'd always hated that nickname ever since it had been given to me at the academy. The reason why I never liked it when they called me the Bloodhound was because the nickname made it seem like I was a deranged psychopath. I often asked my fellow detectives why they gave me that nickname, and they always told me that it was because whenever I got a scent of blood, I chased it down to the ends of the earth. While that was true, I still didn't like the title, but the more I fought it, the worse it got. So I just let it be. I thanked Officer Saunders for his belief in me and my partner before saying, "While I'm grateful for your faith in me, Chief Saunders, I'd like to tell you that I'm not that great of a detective. I'm really not any different from all the detectives who are out there currently working on this case, but I can promise you that my partner and I will try our best to put a face on the man or woman who has been terrorizing the Church and Wellesley neighborhood." Chief Officer Saunders then chuckled before ending our conversation with,
"There's no need to be modest, Detective Stone. I know you are the best of the best, and I have faith that you will be the one to help us solve this mystery."
After that, my partner and I bid the chief officer goodbye and went to meet the leading Canadian detectives on the case. It took a few hours for my partner and me to get up to speed, but we had all the information we needed, and we immediately got to work. Once I had studied the case files, I fully understood why this case had been unsolved for over 7 years. Chief Officer Saunders had said it himself during our conversation when he described this case as a very complex one that still puzzled the Toronto State Police. One of the main reasons for the many complexities that plagued the case was the similar lifestyle of most of the victims. The records showed that these men frequently used a lot of dating apps before they went missing, and this would later cause huge problems for the Toronto police, who were trying to pinpoint the last people they'd come in contact with during their investigations. The detectives knew that, due to the nature of dating apps, the victims often met with strangers they'd never seen before. The authorities had already attempted to track down and question a few of the people the missing men had met with on the dating apps, but their efforts proved fruitless, as they faced many difficulties getting judicial authorizations to access the data from the dating app's servers that were located outside Canada. Everything about the missing person's case was either complicated or convoluted, and it became much clearer to me why the authorities were having such a difficult time finding the killer. I knew I had to take a different approach to solving the case, and I began by looking for the patterns. As a detective, one of the first things you're taught to sniff out in a case are the patterns, and this one had a few. The first thing I noticed was the physical similarities in most of the victims. They were all middle-aged men who sported beards or some sort of facial hair, and 6 out of the 8 victims were either from the Middle East or South Asia. These similarities couldn't have been a coincidence, and it was clear that the killer had a type. This led me to believe that these weren't hate crimes or hate killings, as some other detectives believed, and I knew for a fact the killer was homosexual. All the patterns pointed towards this being the case because all the missing people were either openly gay or closeted gays who were living double lives from their families. The victims were most likely lured under the pretense of sex and a good time by the serial killer, who then killed them after they agreed to go with him. Another odd pattern I noticed in the case was that most of the victims disappeared during holiday weekends. Mr. Kinsman, who was the most recent disappearance, was taken after the Toronto Pride celebration, and Mr. Essen, who went missing before him, disappeared on Easter. These similarities also apply to the killer's earlier kidnappings, as Mr. Navaratnam vanished on Labor Day. Mr. Kane was reported missing during Thanksgiving, and Mr. Fazy was taken after Christmas. The investigation also showed that all the missing men had very social lives, in addition to many ties at the church and Wellesley community, and they frequently visited a popular bar in the city that was known as the Black Eagle Bar. I knew it would be pointless to try to find leads by tracking down the reoccurring visitors of the Black Eagle Bar, as it was a very popular bar, so I decided to look where the blood trail was still the freshest, and I made my way to the home of Andrew Kinsman. The Toronto police had already searched through Mr. Kinsman's apartment as they looked for any signs of struggle or incriminating evidence that could lead them to the killer. But they didn't find anything after their search, so I decided to take a different route when I got to the apartment later that afternoon. I was looking for anything in particular as I looked around Kinsman's apartment, because many years as a detective had taught me that, in cases like this, it's often the insignificant things that can lead to the truth. It could be anything, like the TV program the victim was watching that night, what they'd eaten for dinner, or a crumpled up to-do list written on a sticky note. I looked around for a few hours, and it wasn't long before I saw what I'd been looking for out of the corner of my eye. It was a calendar on the wall that belonged to Andrew Kinsman. I'd noticed it had numerous unimportant scribbles on it, but there was one thing that stood out to me, and it was what Mr. Kinsman wrote on his calendar for the 26th of June 2017. The very same day he went missing. The other unimportant entries had shown Mr. Kinsman liked writing his activities for the day on his calendar. But on the 26th, he'd written down the name of the man that he'd planned to meet that day, and that man's name was Bruce. We'd finally gotten a name after 7 long years of investigations, but I knew that wasn't enough. So I quickly acquired the surveillance footage from the day Mr. Kinsman disappeared. While reviewing the surveillance footage from the 26th of June, I saw Mr. Kinsman enter a red minivan. Even after watching the footage numerous times, it was impossible to identify the car's plate or the driver in front, as the images weren't clear, but I could tell what type of car that the killer drove, and it was a 2004 Dodge Caravan. I quickly called Emily to ask her to find out how many similar Dodge Caravans were used in Church and Wellesley and the wider Toronto, and she called me back in a few hours, telling me that there were over 6,000 similar models. I then asked how many models were registered under the name Bruce, and she told me that there were only 5 caravans that were registered under the name Bruce. I knew I'd finally gotten him in that moment, as my final question to Emily was, how many of the 5 Dodge Caravans were 2004 models? Emily looked into it for a couple of minutes before calling me back to tell me that only one of the 5 was a 2004 model, and it belonged to a man named Bruce MacArthur. His full name was Thomas Donald Bruce MacArthur, and investigations into him revealed he was a known landscaper in the Church and Wellesley neighborhood. Further investigations also showed that Bruce MacArthur was a notorious homosexual who had a reputation for enjoying rough sex and BDSM. His record stated that he'd been banned from the Church and Wellesley neighborhood in 2003 due to his violent outbursts and aggressive behaviors in bars and towards the residents. This wasn't the first time his name had come up in this investigation, as Bruce MacArthur was interrogated during the initial investigations carried out in 2013 by the Toronto State Police. Bruce was interviewed on the 11th of November 2013 after the disappearances of Mr. Navaratnam and Mr. Cahan. An anonymous tip given to the authorities stated Bruce had a romantic relationship with Mr. Navaratnam and was seen on numerous occasions with Mr. Cahan. During the interview, Bruce denied ever having a romantic relationship with Mr. Navaratnam, and he told the authorities he employed Mr. Cahan at his landscaping company called Artistic Designs for a while, which is why they were seen together. The authorities had no reason not to believe him at the time, and no evidence proved otherwise, so Bruce was let go as he wasn't considered a major suspect. Apart from the calendar, we didn't have any hard evidence against Bruce MacArthur to prove he was guilty, but I already knew he was the one responsible for the atrocities that occurred in Church and Wellesley, so I traced the movement of his car on the 26th of June 2017 using street surveillance footage. It wasn't long before I tracked the red minivan to Bruce's apartment building, as that was the car's last destination on the 26th of June, but when we showed up at his residence, the car wasn't there anymore. I quickly carried out additional investigations into the car's whereabouts, and the records showed that Bruce had sold the vehicle. It took a whole team to find Bruce's car, but we were able to track it down to a place called Dom's Auto Parts in Courtis, Ontario. My partner and I were accompanied by a few other detectives, and we arrived at Dom's Auto Parts on the 3rd of October 2017. I made sure we were all dressed in plain clothes rather than uniforms so we wouldn't scare any potential witnesses away. And after waiting for a few minutes, we informed the owner, Mr. Dominique Vettieri, that we were looking for a red 2004 Dodge Caravan. Mr. Vettieri told us that the car was sold to him on the 16th of September 2017 by a man named Bruce MacArthur, and luckily for us, the car was still intact, so we took it in for examination. The results of the car's examination showed that there were traces of blood in its interior, with a lot of samples found around the boot. These blood samples were immediately sent to forensics for further examination, and the forensics results confirmed that the blood samples belonged to Andrew Kinsman. We'd finally gotten hard evidence in the case, and Bruce MacArthur was put under surveillance, and after we fully studied and tracked his everyday movements, he was arrested on the 18th of January 2018. The authorities arrested Bruce when they saw an unidentified man enter his apartment. The man, whose name was John, was believed to be Bruce's next victim, but luckily, the authorities intervened before he lost his life. John was a family man who hadn't told his wife that he was gay, and during his statement, John mentioned meeting Bruce on a dating app called Growler, which was one of the known methods Bruce used to lure his victims. Bruce's apartment was searched, and all his electronic devices were confiscated. The authorities found numerous images of Mr. Essence and Mr. Kinsman's corpses on Bruce's computer that he'd initially kept as trophies. He tried to delete these images, but they were recovered by the computer forensics specialists. Further examinations into the DNA samples found in Bruce's car were also carried out, and the results showed some of the DNA samples in the car belonged to Mr. Salim Essen. We had more than enough now to charge Thomas Bruce MacArthur with 2 counts of first-degree murder. But the question still remained, where are the bodies? The entire Toronto police force was already searching numerous properties that were linked with Bruce and his landscaping business, but they weren't able to find anything. During the search, there was one particular place that piqued my interest when I studied the case, and it was the Mallory Crescent residence located in Leaside. The owners of Mallory Crescent residence were one of Bruce's oldest landscaping clients, and I had a gut feeling that he might have hidden something there. The occupants of the building had already been told to stay away from their home during the investigation, so I took my partner Emily and we made our way to the house as we wanted to look around ourselves before the forensics arrived. We searched the entire place, but we couldn't find any trace of the victim's bodies. I started to feel tense now, as I knew how important it was for the victim's families to get their bodies. But even after all our efforts, we couldn't find a single drop of blood. I eventually started having disturbing thoughts during the search, as I thought Bruce had driven out to the ocean and disposed of the bodies there so we could never find them. While I hoped that wasn't the case, it truly seemed like Bruce had wiped every trace of their corpses from existence. We looked around for hours without finding anything, and right when I was about to give up, my partner Emily looked at me and said, "Hey, Matt, we both know the killer is a landscaper, right? So why are we searching the most conventional places for the corpses? There's no way he hid the bodies in the backyard or placed them in large rubber barrels in the garage. We need to think like him, and while I'm not completely sure, I'm willing to bet he probably buried the bodies in some nearby flower beds or any gardens in the vicinity. That's where we should be focusing our energy on." As soon as the words flower beds came out of Emily's mouth, I knew she was onto something. I'd been working with her for a few years now, and in that time, I realized that junior detective Emily Scott has such a very perspective and intuitive mind. She could always see the things that most people gloss over, and with her intelligence, she could always put the clues together. Most of her superiors at the Detective Academy said she was stubborn, but I knew she was just a quick-witted person who strongly believed in her theories, and that's why I chose her as my partner. Even though she was still a junior detective, I knew she'd grow to become one of the best detectives in the world. I decided to follow Emily's advice, so we shifted our focus toward any plant beds or gardens in the area, and it wasn't long before we came across these large planter boxes located in a nearby ravine. While they looked like normal planter boxes, I could tell something was off. Winter had frozen the boxes to the ground, which meant they'd been there for a while, and I had a gut feeling that these plant boxes were exactly what we were looking for. The forensic investigators arrived a few minutes after that, and they came with cadaver dogs. Unsurprisingly, these dogs couldn't stop sniffing the plant boxes that Emily and I had located earlier. It wasn't long before the planters were taken to the coroner's office for examination, and when the plants had been uprooted, numerous skeletal remains were found buried in the plant bed. It was a truly horrific discovery, as even more dismembered and rotting human remains were found in the other plant boxes in the vicinity. The mystery that had plagued the Toronto police for years was finally solved, as it was later revealed that Bruce had taken advantage of his clients and placed the remains of all 8 victims into these plant boxes during his landscaping jobs. With the discovery of all 8 bodies, the missing persons cases were all closed, and for the first time in 7 years, the residents of the Church and Wellesley neighborhood were at peace. On the 29th of January, 2019, Thomas Bruce MacArthur pleaded guilty to the 8 first-degree murder charges that he was facing. Bruce himself admitted to sexually assaulting, killing, and dismembering all 8 men in court, and due to his confession, there was no need for a trial. He was then sentenced to life imprisonment by Justice John McMahon on the 8th of February, 2019. The chief of the Toronto Police Service called us to his office after Bruce's sentencing, and he thanked me and Emily for all our support in the investigation. We left Toronto Pearson International Airport that afternoon, as we'd already been called back for another case. As we made our way to the airport, I told Emily that I didn't really see the operation as a complete success. We weren't able to save any of the missing persons' lives, and to make matters worse, their corpses had been mutilated. But I told myself that there was still a small silver lining to all this in the end, because I was able to find and bring Toronto's man-eater to justice. The case of Thomas Bruce MacArthur is one of the most disturbing true crime cases the country of Canada has ever seen. Their perpetrator, Bruce MacArthur, still holds the title of the deadliest known serial killer in Toronto. He is also stated to be the most prolific gay serial killer in Canada due to his crimes. Bruce MacArthur terrorized the Church and Wellesley neighborhood from 2010 to 2017, and it would take the combined efforts of the Toronto Police Service, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and the Ontario Provincial Police to bring him to justice. During the height of the investigation, some of the most skilled detectives were called to assist in solving the case, and it was due to their efforts that the victim's remains were found. Bruce, who was now 72 years of age, is still serving out his life sentence at the maximum security prison, Millhaven Institution in Ontario.